You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. The night of May 25th, 2020, changed America. George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, was killed during an arrest in Minneapolis when a white cop suffocated him. The video of that night's events went viral, sparking the largest protests in the nation's history and the sort of social unrest we haven't seen since the 60s. While George Floyd's death was certainly a catalyst, heightened by the fact that it occurred during a pandemic whose victims were disproportionately of color, it was, in truth, the fuse that lit an ever-filling powder keg. Now, in his new book, titled Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America, best-selling author, Vanderbilt professor, and leading public intellectual Dr. Michael Eric Dyson grapples with the cultural and social forces that have shaped our nation in the brutal crucible of race and traces the genealogy of anti-blackness from the slave ship to the street corner where Floyd lost his life, and where America gained its will to confront the ugly truth of systemic racism. And today, Michael joins me on the podcast to talk about his decision to address race in America through a series of letters to black martyrs, why we all know the name George Floyd, but we might not know the name Elijah McClain, and how he's seeking to educate white people about the centuries of violence against blacks that have led up to this moment. He explains the origins of what he calls the black political economy of the night and how it ties into modern-day looting and rioting and what's really meant by the rallying cry to defund the police. He says cancel culture has an insidious effect of fracturing black unity and calls on white folks to back up their holy hashtags and black squares on Instagram with real action. Plus, he expresses his dismay that a large part of white America and even a decent segment of black America failed to reject Donald Trump's racist rhetoric and policies in 2016, his faith that President-elect Joe Biden will follow through on his promise to black voters, and why even in the face of racism, discrimination, and violence, Michael still remains hopeful for a better future. Coming up with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson in just a moment. Dr. Michael Eric Dyson is a distinguished university professor of African American and Diaspora Studies and of Ethics and Society and Centennial Professor at Vanderbilt University. A contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, Dyson is the author of 7 New York Times bestsellers, including Jay-Z, Tears We Cannot Stop, and What Truth Sounds Like. He's a recipient of 2 NAACP Image Awards and the 2020 Langston Hughes Festival Medallion and is considered one of America's leading public intellectuals. Indeed, former President Barack Obama once noted, quote, "Everybody who speaks after Michael Dyson pales in comparison." That comes shining through in his latest bestseller, a passionate call for this country to finally deal with race and start the journey to redemption, titled Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. Dr. Dyson, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, my friend. It's great to be here.
Well, Michael, I really enjoyed this book. I found it enlightening, inspiring, and heartbreaking all at once. And the majority of the book is framed as letters from you to various black martyrs like Emmett Till. But you actually opened the book with a poem that pays tribute to one living legend, LeBron James. What's the significance of LeBron to you?
Well, I think LeBron is an extraordinary figure. In this period of racial reckoning that we are undergoing in America, in the attempt to bring justice, truth, and democracy to the fore, and to provide a better standard of living for those who have been marginalized and to address the racial catastrophes through which we have lived, LeBron James has been a singular force and a singular figure who, with, you know, his global authority as a sports icon, named, I think, for the third time, Sports Illustrated's Man of the Year, I think that's some kind of record, has leveraged his global fame in defense of vulnerable Black people and speaking powerfully and articulately for justice at the height of his fame, not after he's gone, not after he's finished with his career. And so I wanted to honor that extraordinary achievement and his incredible pedigree.
You know, it's kind of funny because we white folks go nuts about LeBron or Michael Jordan, Miles Davis, Denzel, Beyonce, but I'm just taking a guess here that the majority of white Americans can only name two prominent Black people who aren't athletes or artists, Barack Obama and Martin Luther King.
Right.
So what does it say to you that white people are so obsessed with Black athletes and performers to the exclusion of all other Black achievement?
Well, we appreciate the appreciation of the black athletes, the Black entertainers, some of the Black leaders. Some they may know negatively, whether Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, though those figures should be certainly redeemed and restored to their rightful place of high regard in the collective white mindset. But it says we've got more work to do in white America to figure out that, you know, the most precious resource is the ordinary Black person who, with great dignity and extraordinary diligence, has made a way out of no way, has risen high on the totem pole of American achievement. And whether or not the dominant culture recognizes or acknowledges them, they have done remarkable things with what they have in their possession. So many millions of Black people who continue to thrive, who continue to hunger for better, who continue to desire that this nation live up to the true meaning of its creed, as Martin Luther King Jr. said. So I think, you know, it was, and I cite this in the book, I think it was Fannie Lou Hamer, the great civil rights leader, who said, "The mistake white folk made is that they put us behind them because they thought we were inferior as opposed to in front of them. And when they put us behind them, we could look at everything white folk do. We could learn white people. We have to learn whiteness, white ways, white dispositions, white habits, white desires, white angers, because depending upon that knowledge could save us. Our survival was dependent on us mastering and knowing white moods, white maladies, and white habits and practices." But a lot of white folk weren't inspired or encouraged or compelled to learn in return about Black people. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, it shows up perhaps in that suggestion that ordinary Black people or Black people even of high achievement may not, you know, register on the radars of white America in the same way that a Beyonce or a Jay-Z will. And yet we know that Black people of high achievement and an extraordinary pedigree are there for the knowing if white curiosity would cure the ignorance.
Do you think it's demeaning that white people focus so heavily on Black entertainers and athletes, almost as if Black people only exist to amuse white audiences? On some level, isn't it just sort of a modern day form of minstrelization of Blacks?
Well, from your mouth to white ears, and you said it with eloquence. Look, we appreciate, again, the acknowledgement of Black athletic genius. I don't want to deny, and I know you aren't either. We don't want to deny what LeBron or Kobe or Jordan or Denzel or LeBron or Oprah are doing, but we want to say that we're bigger than that. We're beyond that. And yes, there is something about the ghettoization of white knowledge of Black culture into these spheres. Although, let's be real, it was the Black athlete and the Black entertainer who brokered awareness of and brokered acceptance for Black people in the white world because of the very fact you're talking about. Mm-hmm. White folk would say, well, they would make exceptions for, you know, Black entertainers and Black athletes. They were better than the regular Blacks. They are not like the regular Blacks. And this is why we love LeBron James. LeBron James said, no, I'm one of them. I am part of who they are. I started at the bottom. I started without a father in the home. I started with a single mother. I started in poverty in Akron, Ohio, and now I'm at the top of the food chain, so to speak. But I recognize those people who fed me and fueled me. And yes, I think it's extremely important for white brothers and sisters to understand that even though white entertainers and white athletes brokered awareness and acceptance, and that's a good way to open the door, you got to walk through it. You got to see the richness of Black culture, the diversity of Black culture, the contradictions, the paradoxes, the complexity of Black culture and complexities of Black culture to understand fully who we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to move to the meat of your book, which is these letters that you've written to slain Black men and women who were the victims of racial injustice, from Emmett Till to Eric Garner. Why did you choose the epistolary form to get your point across in this book?
Yeah, I wanted to have a sense of intimacy, of intimate and familiar conversation. Kinfolk, writing a letter to somebody you know, somebody you admire, somebody you've come to know, or somebody you only learned of after their death. That's one of the great ironies, perhaps even a paradox of this epistolary form. I'm writing to people who can't really hear me, but I want them to hear me collectively. I want Black people in white America and Indigenous folk and Native and, you know, Asian folk. I want all people to hear what I'm saying by, you know, imagining a conversation between me and Breonna Taylor, me and Elijah McClain, me and George Floyd, me and Eric Garner, me and Sandra Bland or Reverend Clemente Pinckney, and Emmett Till, to imagine what it means to sit there and to talk with them, recently arrived ancestors for the most part, with the exception of Emmett Till. How do we struggle? Let me talk through this with you. Let me sit at your graveside metaphorically and hash it out with you and talk about the pain, the predicament, the trauma, the hurt, the sorrow that we feel, the grief that we endure as a result of that, and figure out ways to grapple with our situation. So it provided me an opportunity to talk to them, not simply talk about them.
And you talk about the fact that none of the Black people you talk to in these letters ever wanted to die for a cause or to be a martyr. You know, they didn't have some vision of their own sacrifice as part of a larger cause in, say, the way that Martin Luther King may have. They were just minding their own business and were struck down. So I'm curious, in your mind, what is the distinction between a martyr and a victim?
Yeah, it's a great question. And no, they didn't intend to die for a greater cause. And usually we ascribe that intentional willingness to sacrifice one's life to a martyr. But I call them martyrs here, not just victims. They are victims of white supremacy, white vigilantism, or police brutality, but they are also, I think, martyrs in the following sense, that the use to which their death is put, the making of meaning of their memory, allows them a vocation of martyrdom that is ascribed to them, that they did not intentionally pursue, but the use of their memories to provoke significant social outrage or social action or protests in the street suggests that their death, though not intending to do so, has achieved a certain kind of visibility and viability that pushes the needle, that moves the needle of social change, that forces America to reckon with the outrageous incidents of police brutality or white supremacy that we see manifest. So in that sense, I do believe that they are martyrs.
Interesting. And I want to talk about that. You have a chapter in here addressed to a young man named Elijah McClain, who died tragically at the hands of police and was just minding his own business. Very innocent, totally gentle person. It's a real tragedy. But I wonder, how come we all know the name George Floyd, but we don't know the name Elijah McClain?
Yeah, it's a great point. We don't know a whole bunch of names, by the way.
Sure.
Too many Black names to remember. And I name a bunch of them in the book, and that is just the tip of the iceberg. That's barely scratching the list, so to speak. So I think we don't know Elijah McClain because he was yet another anonymous Black person who got lost in the shuffle of so many Black deaths of so many Black people succumbing to white brutality in the form of police, and the willful denial of the opportunity to any longer exist that seems to be the prerogative of white people who are police people, or police people who are in general of whatever race, denying the ability of Black people to thrive, to flourish, to survive even. And so many of us have met that fate that we can't recall all of them. Although, as you do indicate, the egregious character of the death of Elijah McClain, an innocent, sweet young man, 23 years old, perhaps on the spectrum, we don't know, but we know he played the violin to pigeons and birds to soothe and calm them. One of his coworkers said he walked as if he had a gold orb around him. A loving young man, even when the police accosted him, he tried to talk to them. He tried to speak to them with tenderness and emotion and empathy. He speaking to them with tenderness and empathy and emotion, trying to calm them down. They are escalating the situation unnecessarily. And we see the brutal punishing consequence of this kind of police brutality when we witness a young man who meant no harm, who intended no ill will toward those police people. They choked him, put him in a chokehold twice, rendered him unconscious. And then when the EMT arrived, or, you know, the ketamine was, you know, injected into his veins, he went into shock. A week later, he was dead. So this is a horror and a tragedy that should be better known. But because the density of numbers of Black people who have succumbed, all of them can't be highlighted. Yet in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, Elijah McClain's plight and predicament and circumstance and situation came to greater light. And the reason we know him now is because of George Floyd's death and the reckoning we attempted to undergo and to undertake. And I wanted to highlight him even more by leading off my book with his story.
And so much of this book does a wonderful job of putting recent events into historical context, because, you know, there are so many white people who just now got woke after George Floyd. And you point out in here that there's a long, long, long history going back 200 years. And white people, for the majority of us, have pretty much been asleep. Was that part of your goal to point out, okay, yes, you're paying attention to what happened now, but where were you 200 years ago?
Yeah, bless your heart for saying that. I don't want to, you know, remonstrate morally against white brothers and sisters, but you make a compelling point. And I do want to suggest, think about that is the case. Think about Dr. King's sermon, remaining awake through a great revolution. So you got to stay awake. The revolution has been going on for a while. A lot of white brothers and sisters are just now getting in the game, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And while I appreciate that, and I'm thankful at whatever point they've entered, to enter strongly and to enter decisively and to enter with the attempt to try to resolve some of the conundrums, the paradoxes, the contradictions we've had, and some of the racial cataclysms and the racial hurts and pains we've endured, it is good to ask the question, why just now, so that white brothers and sisters can remain awake. Because when you get woke, you got to go to sleep. So you need an alarm clock to wake you up again, right? You can't even stay awake for 300-400 years, even though Black people feel that we've been awake since 401 years ago in 1619. We haven't been able to get a good night's sleep. We've had collective and colossal Black sleep apnea. So we've been forced awake by the paralyzing conditions of white supremacy and the dominant culture and the inequality that results, even if not intentionally so. So yeah, I wanted to suggest that there were reasons perhaps that now white people were awakened. The pandemic was here. More of us were looking at our screens. More of us were at home. More of us were paying attention. So when it came across our screens, we were able to absorb it more quickly. And we had heard about the pandemic and its disproportionate impact on Black bodies and brown bodies. So we're a little bit more sympathetic, many white people were, to the plight and predicament of Black people, and thinking, my God. Also, they were deprived of excuses. Like, oh, you must have said something wrong to the police. Not that that should get you killed. We saw a white guy 2 days ago basically curse the police out or threatened them, said he was going to kill them, and they still let him go even though they later chased him down and arrested him. But he had a gun sitting on his seat next to him and was arguing with the police. And they withdrew their guns from their holsters and pointed them at him. And he dared them to use them, said that they were violating his rights, talked about his Second Amendment rights and the like, and pulled off after that encounter. That's remarkable. So, you know, even when white brothers and sisters speak ill toward the police, they are not killed. But Black people have to be especially careful about how we speak to the police, about how we talk to the police, how we interact with them. And some white people didn't have that excuse anymore. And they didn't have the excuse of, well, you must have run from the police or you must have tried to harm them. He's laying prostrate on the ground with the knee of the officer, Derek Chauvin, boring into his neck. I think that got to white people in a way that few things had before. And it forced a lot of white people to join the movement, the Black Lives Matter marches and protests at the greatest number and greatest clip ever in the history of this nation.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, I want to ask you about the defund the police or abolish the police movement, because I have a hard time believing that anyone truly wants no cops on the streets at all and just wants to accept anarchy. So is it meant to be taken literally, or is it more of a shock slogan to wake people up, or even perhaps a negotiating tactic of sorts? You know, let's take an extreme position knowing that we'll probably meet in the middle, but we get some progress. What is the point of it?
Well, all of that makes sense, really. But look at what's egregious. Look at the chaos. Look at the carnage. Look at the chaos that we're dealing with policing, and, you know, in full effect. Mm-hmm. Black people are essentially dealing with the anarchy of an out of control police force. Police unions have very little limits. And you think about the police union in New York, full of vituperative, vile, vitriolic, disgusting denunciations of citizens. Now, they don't say it in explicit terms, but almost so. And the hatefulness that is expressed by some of these police union leaders is utterly dispiriting. So we have anarchy and chaos already as Black people with the police. That's why we're saying, please stop. And I'm always interested in the people who are more outraged at the outrage that we have for being hurt
right,
than what causes it in the first place. So we can even imagine, it could have been a better word. Yeah, we could have chosen a better phrase. Is that really the point, though? Is that the issue? I'm uncomfortable with the phrase you use, but I'm not uncomfortable with you dying. I'm not uncomfortable with Black people getting killed. That's not what outrages me. Yeah. I didn't go, you know what, including a former president, you know what? This is outrageous and egregious and ludicrous, as Mike Tyson would say, that Black people die the way they do. Now, I thought you could have used a better phrase, but I'm more interested in the hurt and harm that you are enduring than the phraseology. Mm-hmm. Now, I think I'm part of the Black left. I'm part of the progressives. We got to be able to take critique and take criticism seriously. And even though Obama, when he said that made that criticism of the defund the police by saying, look, you got to choose a better phrase because you lost half the people when you start off. He's saying that as Pharaoh, not the children of Israel. He's not saying that for the people who saying Pharaoh, let my people go. He's Pharaoh himself. So, of course, he's going to see it from Pharaoh's a pharaonic position. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not a judgment of him. That's an analysis of his power relationship and what power he wielded in this country. Having said all that, even if you're on the left, you got to figure out, let's use the best words. Let's use the best phrases. Maybe that will provoke people to think ill. But that's not what they were thinking about. They were thinking about the most literal description of what they want to have happen. Now, defunding the police means that we're going to transfer some funds from one area to another. You know, look at LA, $150 million away from the police toward other arenas. The police are not the only public safety guardians in our culture. And why are we sending the police when somebody's having a psychotic breakdown? The police are not trained in that. They are using guns. They are wielding batons. They are deploying tasers, hurting the weak, the already vulnerable flesh of those they are trying to engage. So there are many ways in which we can reimagine policing. Maybe we should have called it reimagining police as opposed to defunding police. And I think that would have been a way to invite people in to a conversation. And the left has to grow up. Yes, that may not be the best word or phrase to use. And we must be honest about that. Even as we say, let's not be most upset with the person who uses that phrase as the person who was forced to rethink policing from the very beginning.
But this focus on the phrase, you know, it also makes me think of how when the protests erupted, a lot of white people, instead of acknowledging that a black man or a black woman was slain at the hands of the police, want to focus on all the rioting and the looting going on. And I'm interested in this book. You talk about that in the context of what you call the black economy of night and go back into the history of that. Can you tell us a little about that? I found that fascinating.
Yeah. Well, what black people were forced to do at night, what they, you know, they were allowed to go fishing and hunting and visiting their girlfriends or boyfriends or their husbands or wives, or to go to church. And so I talk about the political economy of night, what black people did at night to recreate the world. And we see it updated now when nighttime activities, whether it's sporting events or whether it's going to parties or whether it's using our own informal situations of gathering from sororities and fraternities to really remake American society in our image and to put forth our arguments about the advance of our race collectively. And so it's extremely important to understand what black people have had to do. They have had to use what they have at their disposal to really make a huge impact on a world that deprived them of so many resources, that deprived them of so many opportunities. And the political economy of night is where black people concentrated their energies and their efforts.
And you poignantly recall the story of your own brother in this book, who was part of that underground economy that you talk about. He sold drugs and was arrested for murder and died in prison. You say in here that you don't believe the charges against him. So do you consider him a martyr as well?
I mean, I wouldn't consider him a martyr in the same way I consider the other folk that I write this book about. But I do consider him in that sense to be a tragic victim of a culture that so readily rushes young black people into prison without a just hearing or often without evidence. There was no evidence in my brother's case except what they call a dying declaration. And it the man who was killed said something sounding like my brother's name. So in many other instances where, you know, there was no physical evidence, there was nothing else, there was no trace of blood or anything, right? So my brother was convicted by an all-black jury, by the way, with, I think, scant evidence. So, you know, in one sense, I guess one could say he was martyred for a legal justice system that continues, that refuses to recognize that a lot of black people who are killed, who are put to death on death row, or who suffer a fate of life in prison are unjustly there. So in another sense, of course, I guess we could stretch the term and use it for martyrdom, but the immediate sense that I mean it has to do with the death of black people against their will for a violently for a purpose that they did not necessarily consciously commit themselves to, but for whom a society for whom their death represents a powerful advance in an argument about doing justice for us.
And I found it very interesting that in this book you talk about cancel culture. Why is cancel culture so insidious, particularly from the standpoint of the black community?
I think it's insidious because it doesn't really answer the true quest for justice. It doesn't, you know, it might remove a particular person from a particular scenario, but it doesn't remove the system that produces them. And it's often adjudicated in ways that are not fair, that don't allow for what's counter evidence? What's a counterclaim? Okay, we are accusing this person of it. What does that person say? Can that person face his or her accusers? You know, and there is just it's just a vicious, you know, digital mob taking the lynch party and displacing it and putting it into an arena where it's online. And so social media becomes the arena within which those vicious practices are observed. And as a result of that, it doesn't resolve the ultimate problem. And it's no mistake that both gender and race are the arenas within which cancel culture occurs, primarily, right? With the Me Too movement and with the anti-racist movement. And trying to cancel people, to me, is white supremacy by proxy, right? White supremacy wants to cancel, eviscerate, get rid of. The best of Black traditions of restorative justice are about holding people to account, but by offering gestures of forgiveness and love and embrace. Not that we don't hold people stringently to account and people suffer the consequences of their actions, but they are able to return, to be restored, to be able to come forth under the arc of forgiveness and of restitution and restoration and achieve a life that is better than before. But if you cancel them, ain't none of that happening. And I don't think that's us at our best.
Yeah. Now I hear a little bit of the preacher in you, Michael.
No doubt about it, brother. I got 41 years Baptist preacher, and I admit that has informed what I think about cancel culture.
Is there any value to, you know, white people's virtue signaling, putting Black Lives Matter signs on their lawn and posting a black square on Instagram? Or is it just a cheap way for white people to let themselves off the hook and feel better about themselves?
Well, it can be both, right? It certainly can be the latter and the kind of virtue signaling that's going on. But look, I'll take, as opposed to what I saw with Donald Trump, who doesn't care, who tries to care about Black people, who tries to outlaw or rule out of play in government arenas, discourse about diversity and seeing it as hate speech, then give me some virtual signaling. Give me some white folk who want to post a black square on Instagram. Give me white folk who want to talk about Black Lives Matter, because that's a beginning. Because where I meet you doesn't mean that's where I leave you. And where we meet first doesn't mean that's where we end. So when Jesus met the woman at the well, he just wanted to drink a water. Hey, how you doing? Can I get some water? It's kind of thirsty out here. Then he starts having a big theological discussion about the nature of her personal life and the domestic need for transformation. So for me, you know, you can meet folk at the church, at the well of Black Lives Matter, and they begin to think critically about their lives. Then you invite them. Let's do a little bit more. It's more than posting. You got to post bail, post bond, when you are imprisoned in a narrow conception of Blackness and you want to get whiteness out of there. You want to get the white folk that you know who are imprisoned in those narrow jail cells of consciousness out of there. You want to bail them out. So you want to do more than post. You want to think. You want to challenge. You want to reflect. You want to begin to integrate into your own workplace and your workspace and your home the ideas that can help people in a far better fashion.
I wonder, do you understand where some Black people come from when they say something along the lines of, you know, it's not my job to spend my time and energy educating white people about Black life, Black history, Black culture? You know, I get that you're a college professor, so education is kind of your thing, but can you relate to that sense of exhaustion?
Oh, sure, I get it. I mean, I'm exhausted myself sometimes, like, damn, not again. I thought we told you already.
Yeah.
And part of the exhaustion of certain Black people is the feeling that you done had Du Bois, you done had A. Philip Randolph, you done had Martin Luther King Jr., you done had Angela Davis, you done had James Baldwin, you had Maya Angelou. Damn, what can I tell you that they haven't said? What? You got to read. The blueprint is there. Go check it out. Don't try to build a building without the blueprint and act like you need a blueprint to build a building when the blueprint is already there. Blueprint one, blueprint two, blueprint three by Jay-Z especially. But the blueprint is there. It's been laid out time and again. Yes, we want to update it. Yes, we want to refresh your memories. Yes, we should talk to you, those of us who are willing to do so. But understand why some Black people are just outraged and out of gas and out of excuses and out of reasons to try to help other people, don't be mad at them. Allow them to rest a little bit. Some of them will probably come back around. And if they don't, there's so many other Black people who will be of service and willing to help. But don't judge those Black people for being legitimately and genuinely exhausted.
Right. And you know, I can get how Black people probably get tired of white folks coming to them and asking them dumb questions. You know, like, where do you get your rhythm from? Or is a Black man in a bow tie automatically a Muslim? You know, hell, I worry about irritating you in this interview right now.
No, look, we got to have a sense of humor about those things. And I think humor is really good when in talking to people across a barrier or border or boundary, no matter what it is, race, gender, class, sexuality, religion, and the like. And you know, I tell people, take what you do with deadly seriousness, but don't take yourself seriously at all. What you're doing is extremely important, but in the process, don't think like you're the only one left, or you're the only one with the righteous indignation, or you're the only one who has the right way to do stuff. There are a lot of people out here trying to do it in different ways. So let's figure out the best way that will help the people we know and the white folk who come to us, and to figure out what they must do. And then from there, we can begin to make huge changes in the culture.
Now, if a white person reads this book, they're probably already approaching it with an open mind and a certain interest in what you have to say. Mm-hmm. In some sense, you're kind of preaching to the choir here, aren't you? How do you convert those diehard racists whose minds are already made up? How do you reach those people? Or is it even worth the effort? Do you just write them off or what?
I don't write them off, but you know, it may not be until they're ready to hear that they can hear, right? Even Jesus said, let those who have ears hear. So he's implying everybody ain't gonna hear it. So if you're smart enough, pick it up. If you pick up what I'm putting down, we're on the same page. We're in the same arena. But I don't mind preaching to the choir. I've been a preacher, like I said, for 41 years, and the choir has to rehearse. The altos have to sing their part. The sopranos can't step on the bass, and the bass can't mess with the baritone. You got to figure out what you're doing. When you're singing in a choir, you got to figure out how you harmonize together. You got to come to choir practice. You got to go over and over a song to get it right so that when you perform it, it will be to the glory of the God you claim to represent. So choir rehearsal is important. So preaching to the choir is a beautiful thing.
Now, we were just talking about Trump a minute ago. I have to assume that you were disheartened that more white people did not reject Trump and white nationalism in the 2020 election. I mean, I kind of get if in 2016, maybe it was some kind of a black swan event and they gave him the benefit of the doubt. But after 4 years of this, it's very hard to claim plausible deniability, isn't it?
It is. I'm not saying everybody who voted for Trump is a racist. I'm saying Trump is a racist. And if you voted for him, you were complicitous in racist behavior. So whether that makes you a racist or not, that's between you and your God. But the point is, you are supporting a racist. You are doing things to support what racism wants to achieve. You are enabling racism to go further. Does that make you a racist? You think about that. That's something for you to determine. But at the end of the day, the consequences of your practices are enabling racial beliefs that are detrimental to this nation. And we got to challenge white brothers and sisters, but let's admit it. You know, when I talk in my book about white comfort, we try to comfort white folk at every point. And we say, well, now that the Trump people have lost, why don't you reach out and be kind to them? I ain't heard that when it came to us losing back in 2016.
Right.
Where were the directives to white people? Now, Black people feel lost and they feel hurt for the most part. Reach out to them to make sure they feel part of the government. Ain't heard nothing like that. So now this cuddling, this coddling, you know, this mollycoddling, you know, that is going on is rather interesting and intriguing to me. I do believe in being kind and generous to people, and I do believe that we should reach across whatever aisle that separates us. But at the same time, let's not be hypocritical about how it occurs when Black people or progressive people or other people of color or even poor white people are denied access to a particular goal or ambition, and they are not seen in the same way. They are not felt sorry for or empathetic with in the same way that we're being now invited to feel for Trump voters who have been defeated soundly at the polls.
And on the other hand, we have Joe Biden, who spoke forcefully about racial justice during the campaign, although he did back away from some things like defund the police.
Right.
I know that you endorsed him, and I'm wondering what happens next. Do you believe that he will back it up with actual action? And what do Black people do if he doesn't live up to his promise?
Yep, I believe he will. Back that thing up. Back up what you said. Okay. Get some New Orleans bounce up in there. So, yeah, I believe he will. And I think we have to hold him accountable. You know, we have to hold Joe Biden accountable. We have to hold Kamala Harris accountable. They are our representatives. We believe in them. That's why we voted for them. That's why I endorsed them. But yes, but I think we should hold them accountable. And look, we have a better chance of holding them accountable than Donald Trump. Donald Trump didn't care. There's no accountability to be had. There's no pushing of him. He didn't give a sweet darn about what Black people felt or thought. So as a result of that, let's acknowledge that we begin at a different place with a Joe Biden and a Kamala Harris who met yesterday with the NAACP and other Black leaders who were willing to hear their particular worries or concerns about how many diverse members of a predominantly Black or brown community would be put into place and into the cabinet of Joe Biden. He was open to that. He was willing to meet. He was willing to talk. That's a huge sign of progress in this nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've really enjoyed the conversation, Michael. And real quickly before we go, you end the book with a few paragraphs about hope for a better future. I imagine there are a lot of folks out there, especially Black Americans, who don't share that faith. So what is it that keeps you so hopeful?
Well, man, I'm an old Baptist preacher. And, you know, optimism, Reinhold Niebuhr, the great theologian, said is a shallow virtue. But hope, he said, is deeper. Hope is more profound. Hope exists even when there's no evidence that it should exist. But you create the very possibility for which you strive. That's what hope does. Hope is a delivery service from the future to the present. It's a kind of Uber, Uber Eats that brings you the delicious dessert of tomorrow into the present day and allows you to feast on it if you're willing to believe that it exists. And by investing in that possibility, we create the very society for which we aspire.
Wow. Very, very well said. Well, again, the book is called Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me, my friend. I had a great time.
Thanks again to Michael Eric Dyson for coming on the show. Order Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow him on Twitter at Michael E. Dyson. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.